60 years of vilifying us and carbon has not been the best use of our time. Today's guests are creating a shift. Garo Lisson is building fair trade from the ground up, creating ethical tropical food chains with business partner Dr. Bronner's. Walter Yenne retired from research over 15 years ago to shed some light on the fact that carbon is a resource, and using our knowledge of hydrology to create and sustain the carbon soil sponge, our carbon sequestration can improve by leaps and bounds in literally days, not years. And Mark Lewis is with Trailhead Capital, a far-sighted nonprofit investing in farms and farmers who adopt the regenerative model for food and agriculture. And he's a farmer. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio. Let's dig in. Garo, I think you've outpaced the most fervent Grateful Dead fans with your road trip to create green business trails. It's been going on since when? About 2005?
We started in 2005 when David Bronner and the family thought it's time to shift our ingredients, you know, mostly tropical oils, coconuts, palm oil, and mint oil, shift that to organic and fair trade. This is when the roadshow started.
That's good, the roadshow. And early on, after the tsunami swept through Sri Lanka, your group, Second Aid, put a successful system to work aiding families. And I'm wondering, what did you learn from that that perhaps served you in setting up ethical tropical food chains?
It just confirmed the idea that I've had from when I was pretty young, is that to have any impact, guerrilla tactics, and I mean this in the most peaceful way, are probably best. Meaning, don't rely on governments, organize yourself, look at how you engage with people. And it was a little bit of a philosophy, but it was the only thing that made sense. You know, if you work in countries that have not very effective governments, which, you know, may at times include even the
name
United
one
States.
It does.
I was just thinking. And so you just look at the chaos going on and you think the only way you can have any impact is you get together some money from friends and then you just look at how can you organize support. And you know, that exists here in the United States. There's lots of people that do the same. And what you learn is simply that you cannot trust every victim. This may sound derogatory, but it's not. Even victims sometimes have behavior that's mostly self-serving. And you have to judge in a situation where you want to help people. You can't respond to anybody coming up and say, oh, I need this or that. So it's important, in particular important, to look at what do people need. So you go as far as inventorizing the losses they had from the tsunami, and you make sure that you watch what you give to whom, because people take advantage of situations anytime, and that's just the way it is. So we figured that this combination of acting guerrilla style and assessing needs, and then also closely working with people helping to purchase items, is just more effective than just showing up and handing out money.
Yes.
Which usually doesn't work because it feeds into existing power structures, and that's what we wanted to avoid. I believe that has served us really well in the following 15 years when we developed fair trade system and the question of what fair trade systems should we support, how do you make sure that funds aren't abused, etc. So all this came very handy, but we've never lost our love for, I'd call it direct action, guerrilla style. Sounds a little romanticizing, but it's really looking at what the problem is and then get as close as you can and not have too much bureaucracy in between yourself and those you want to work with.
Yes, and I was surprised in reading your book, Honor Thy Label, that you didn't necessarily just dive in with the local co-ops.
Well, we had the experience, and honestly, when we started Fair Trade, of course, I had no prior experience to that. To me, Fair Trade was something I would buy, and there was coffee, cocoa, and there wasn't much else available. And of course, we thought, democratic self-organization is the only way you want to do that. So naturally, we first, when we contacted an existing co-op, we thought this is the way to go. We realized that its structure and its motivation was completely contrary to what we wanted to accomplish, which is build organic was super important to us and a fair trade system. And the co-op was not really interested in that. It was mostly about just saving their organization. There was little competence and there was self-dealing. And I will never say that this is always the case with co-ops, not at all. But we realized then that in order to achieve what we wanted, which is to support farmers, but also workers, right? We knew we had to build a coconut oil factory, that you want to look at who your primary beneficiaries of this project would be, and they were going to be production workers, and that co-op had just no interest in that whatsoever. That was pretty obvious. So we realized that in certain situations, private sector companies like ourselves and our sister company, Surrenderpol in Sri Lanka, that they may actually do a better job in addressing both the ecological needs as far as agriculture goes and the social needs as far as trying to ensure that everybody along the chain from the farmer to the farm worker to the production worker and then the community gets a fair deal. And this is the first time I become really clear that private sector companies can do that. Of course, you need to make sure that somebody watches over your shoulder and certifies, inspects and certifies that what you do is what you say you do. And that's an old battle, as you know, in certification. And since we had selected a fair trade certification system that does acknowledge and allow the role of privately owned companies and actually exposes them to standards that include the entire supply chain, unfortunately, then existing fair trade certification system, Fair Trade International or FLO, didn't do that at the time. Right? They just looked singularly at farmers, and supply chains go far beyond that. They didn't look at the communities. So we just figured this is what we want to do. We take the responsibility, and we want somebody to look over our shoulders and make sure that what we do, what we say we do. We worked with that co-op for 9 months, and we realized we couldn't make it happen, and then we said, no, we'll do this ourselves. And that's one of the things we've learned from the Second Aid project as well. You can do this yourself. You just have to be clear on what you want and that it's not just making money, but that you have a social commitment there. You want to make sure your partners are in on that. And then you just do that. And lots of experimentation, but it's sure worth it. So we had a pretty heavy first 2 years of learning.
Oh, I can imagine. And all of what you just said really brought up two things. One of them is about always striving to maintain the local traditions and lifestyles. Yep. And yet here you are coming in with a major Western way of doing things. What did you focus on in order to really recognize and enhance and support them in that way?
This is a really good question. Yes, you want to be respectful of local traditions. You don't want to glamorize them either, because local traditions in all countries also have dark sides to them. And those were not the things we focused on. We respected the culture. I love Sri Lankan culture in very many respects, and it's from the trivial, such as the best food on the planet. The way Sri Lankans, they just make fantastic spicy food full of veggies. Most of it by design is vegetarian. And I could eat rice and curry until I die. All day, well, not maybe all day long, but it's pretty good. That's one. And then Sri Lankans have just a very unique, open way of smiling. That doesn't always mean they have the best intentions, right? So solving conflicts, for instance, is not so trivial. And conflicts arise just like they do here, but it's just the setting overall. It's dealing with people is something I respected. It's the culture and traditions, the Buddhist culture. And again, none of this is without the dark side. There's an intolerance towards Muslims, for instance, propagated oftentimes from the mainstream Buddhist culture, et cetera, right? So all of this is just there. You know, we found out there were two things first. You know, we set up the factory. And so there we actually changed working rules quite a bit. There is a pretty big industry that processes coconuts, mostly for grated coconuts, the stuff you use in bacon, for instance. This was at the time a major export article, and still is, from Sri Lanka. So it's called desiccated coconuts. And most of the work there is done manually. And most of the workers were simply on contract. They were casuals. And so if the work was low, there was no money and employment. And this was one of the things we had to change. So we became the first company in Sri Lanka that ran what's called a wet section. It's the cracking of the coconuts and then getting the meat into the next stage. This was done by people who then had a permanent employment and also were guaranteed a wage even when business was down. Right? That was an important change. Then we added benefits that are not that common. Then we started engaging with people. That's more style, you know, the style of cooperation. It's pretty hierarchical in Sri Lanka, I would say. And that's not just Sri Lanka, that's in many countries in the global south, is that there is more of a boss and subordinate behavior, more like you had in the good old days in the US or in Germany, where bosses were always right. And, you know, they wouldn't get their hands dirty. So it was there, and you can't just pretend it doesn't exist. So we got our hands dirty when setting up the mill, etc. And I think that gave us some credibility. But to change the style of interaction with your staff was really important. And I would say respect is what's been our driver. Just treat workers like people. And again, that may sound trivial, but it's not.
And not only that, when you are rolling up your sleeves and getting your hands dirty, as you said, it's important to know each piece of your business that you're into.
Yep. It's that, and that's the funny part of the way we did this, Robin. When we started this project, none of the parties involved had ever done this before. Our partners in Sri Lanka, they knew the coconut business. They were business people, but they also were, I'd say, community-minded. They had helped us massively on the second aid tsunami relief project. Without them, I would have never even started this. But we had to learn on the fly. So we had to build a factory. So we bought a rundown mill that made desiccated coconut, and we had to rebuild it. Well, who does the architecture? So I took an old friend from back in Germany who had become an architect and did this for free, and he and his wife. So we joked, the nicest coconut oil mill probably on the planet. Then we needed machines, and that was not my area of expertise. So I brought in friends to help me design in the absence of prior knowledge ourselves. And those guys, they got their hands dirty. One of them is a farmer and oil miller. And it was really fun to participate in just setting up the silos for the intermediate product and just helping in construction, getting involved in the architecture of it. And I think that set a pretty decent example and laid the ground for what this project would turn into and has become. Things like say thank you, which, you know, often isn't done. So all just these minor details that are not so minor, we try to live by. And I think that has served us very well.
What comes under the category of fair trade that most of us don't even think about?
You could just talk about what's required by standard, and so there's a focus usually on working conditions, and that's fine, and there is compensation for the work. There is a strong focus on prices paid to farmers, of course. Then there's the non-tangibles in there, and we usually say this is treating people with respect. And I sometimes say fair trade is really nothing than a really well-run company with a very strong community orientation, right? So there's quite a bit of money that goes into projects you do on the ground. But in a way, that's how Dr. Bronner's operates in the United States.
Yes,
too, right?
Yes,
so there's
absolutely.
There's a focus on your staff. You want to make sure people have health insurance, are paid fairly. You treat people fair. You give them opportunities to grow. This has become a key issue on all of our projects, is to look at team building, leadership building, and do things that are not common in agricultural projects, Ghana or Sri Lanka or so. This has become almost an obsession, and it's really fun to take these ideas and don't do it in a very dogmatic way, but just look at how do you help teams to grow. They'll never be entirely independent of us because we are the major customer, Dr. Bronner's is, but there's other customers. And for these projects to more and more take over day-to-day operations, make financial decisions, figure out how to deal with staff, that's been a real big part of it. So all this, to me, counts as fair trade. And that's mostly on the human interaction side.
Yes.
One thing we really learned, though, Robin, and this took me about a year to get. So you start with organic and fair trade. And initially, you think organic is mostly about not using pesticides and chemical fertilizers, right? That's what most people think. And I wasn't much beyond that. I had really not paid much attention to the discussion in the U.S., and it was focusing mostly on consumer protection from agrochemicals. So that's one take, but it's narrow. There's older traditions in organic, like biodynamic, and I knew this. But not until we started in Sri Lanka did I realize that organic meant much more. It also means just restoring the fertility and the quality of your soil with natural means.
What you've done with the fair trade, it also makes political inroads, and especially you with Bronner's could say religious inroads, where you're working in the olive oil business. You're creating places for common ground.
Yes, we do that, and that's the beauty, I think, of the work. And that's the fun part, is that they're all in very different cultural settings. The one you're referring to is Canaan, Palestine, in the West Bank. This actually became our first organic and fair trade supplier for olive oil in 2006. So it's not our project, but we're the largest customer, and we've always supported because it's a great project that has attempted to improve the living conditions of olive farmers in the northern West Bank. And at the same time, we buy a smaller quantity from a project in Israel that also works with Israeli Palestinians. Go back and forth between Israel and the West Bank and realize the challenges on either side. Figure out how can you improve the conditions of farmers there and their regenerative agriculture takes on then just its own setting. So it's about, you know, what do you do with the soil under the olive trees? Can you intercrop with almonds? What kind of cover crop do you plant and stop the really deep plowing that's common, for instance? So those are the things that we've done and supported in all projects, is how do you diversify the crop system that's there? How can you bring some of the regenerative measures that people are applying here and make it fit to the local conditions, meaning local soil conditions, the plot size matter, the kind of equipment that people have, and apply regeneration differently to each setting. That's been really one of the most interesting things, and that's where there's a link to fair trade that we also were not aware of. When we started,
right.
You know, initially you think, oh, you pay a better price to the farmers and then they have a better livelihood. That's great. But ultimately, what you really need to do is you need to help farmers improve the fertility of their soil and thus increase their yields and income. That's where fair trade is really strong. It's not just about the price you pay. People just singularly just focus on the price, but it's about improving fertility. And that's where the link between organic and fair trade is really strong. And I got this after about 2 years, and then that we just took this to all projects. Organic and fair are not in different departments. They're the same show. It's all about the same. It's improving livelihoods. Ultimately, ROC includes a social standard, which was not the case in just the USDA organic standard, right? So this is one of the learning. We said these things are so connected, there's got to be a social standard in whatever we do on ROC, because these things belong together very much.
So what's involved in becoming climate positive, and what's the biggest hurdle for Bronner's achieving that projected goal by 2025?
For us is looking at our supply chain and just try to figure out whether you can turn essentially the soil you're growing on, whether this could become a carbon sink. And that means take CO2 from the atmosphere and go into the soil. That goes pretty well with trees, subsurface and below. It's a little different when you grow field crops like the mint, for instance, we grow in India. And there it's about bringing humus back into the soil. In India, we have a massive production of compost that we apply to the soil, work into the soil, then you grow cover crops. And that's ultimately a way to get just your agricultural portion of your supply chain carbon negative.
Got it.
Number one, you eliminate the emissions of greenhouse gases from fertilizer use, like N2O is a big, very potent greenhouse gas. So if you eliminate this, then you just save a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, and then you try to sequester as much CO2 as you can. It's a challenge, and the numbers need to match, and it's much more of a headache, Robin, than you think it is. The dream is to do this all within your own supply chain.
Right. Perfect. Okay, Giro, it appears you have a never-ending sense of possibility. Which of the many disaster situations pose the greatest threat to your ability to just keep swimming, just keep going?
Oh, honestly, it comes down to personal integrity. So we had two situations. You realize that the people you think are good managers of your project, they're not competent, not honest, or either, right? And you had to fire them. And that takes a while. The first time was hard. I'd never fired anybody before. This was a real challenge to figure out how far do you go? How much benefit of the doubt do you give people? How do you remedy situations first? And then when do you need to strike, when you realize people may put entire project at risk? This, honestly, these were the toughest situations, were the month where you realize you have to make a change. And there's going to be all kinds of fallout from this. And you have to wonder, is the project going to survive this or not? Honestly, those were the toughest times. This was 2013 and 2014. And then you get used to it. You just become more and more cautious with partners, but you always need to take risks, right? You need to look at people you want to trust. You just become a little more cautious. But I've never given up on the idea that people overall are pretty cool and well-meaning. You just have to watch it a little bit.
Right. And, Giro, whether it was a natural talent or your job to bring social and business aspects of a community together, you became a brilliant communicator. And what was that like for you, transposing that into writing your book, Honor Thy Labels?
It wasn't so conscious. I think the idea grew. You know, I used to work in industrial hemp. I'm a scientist by training, ecology and renewable source of energy. So I've given talks pretty early on. So I always had a little bit of a teacher in me. And so once we started this work, I gave talks to our staff and then to outside groups or natural food stores in Germany or here. And then eventually we realized this is a story that has more substance and also meaning. And then gradually I conspired with Ryan Fletcher, our chief of PR, to turn this into a book. And I had written a lot, but only technical papers before. And to start writing narrative was a really interesting experience. It's a little bit of psychotherapy. You just start thinking about what you did and try to put this in relative, concise prose. I liked it. It's brutal. Of course, you get the writer's block, right? That's mandatory for anybody who writes. There's just times where you just can't do it because you need inspiration. You need to tell a story that's complex. I had great support. And then I had David Bronner really took part in this. So it became just a really enjoyable way to compile knowledge and narrate it in a way that it's accessible.
30 or 40 or 50 years even down the line, it's going to show a great historic perspective of what had been going on and where things started changing. So very good. Thank you.
The real exciting stuff is the diversification and the growth in all these projects to, I'd say, exemplify regenerative practices and combined with that, the social aspects as far as team building, community development goes. So that's where I'm hoping to go next. But I'm not too eager to spend weeks in government quarantine facilities in Ghana or India. So we'll be sitting this out and wait until you can get back into the countries without major headaches. Regenerative, start speaking to people. And, you know, America sometimes is a little prone to hyperbole. And sometimes people make regenerative agriculture out as the savior, which is not. And it's a lot of bloody work to get it done, but it has some serious potential to improve ecological conditions and hopefully even
economic conditions. Right. I mean, what else? Right? Yeah. What else are we supposed to do here? You know?
It's one of the things that we really could do and integrate our management and use of land and the production of food. Yeah. And that's a pipe dream, just like it was with industrial hemp, but this one is much more realistic. And I like it because there's diversity. There's so many different crops, and it's about how you grow it. And I think that message needs to go out. And poor Bill Gates, his approach is still the mainstream approach and actually much more successful. But it doesn't have the charm that regenerative agriculture has, right? Face it, Bill. Come on. It's a little boring. Right. So one of those days you have to have Bill and me on the show.
Okay, that sounds great. Be sure you send him one of your books.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, we'll do that.
No.
Okay.
Hi, Walter.
Right. Good morning. Thank you very much, Robin. And look, welcome to Australia here down under from all around the world, Robin's audience. Basically, we'd like to really talk about climate change, but also what can we do about it in the sense it's now 50 years since Charles Keeling gave us that stunning evidence that the rise of CO2 levels, its consequence as far as global warming, and raise the questions, what do we do about it? And in fact, it was from that point onwards that we sort of said, look, we have a problem, global warming. What are its consequences to the future? And how is humanity going to address it?
Right. Now, Walter, one of the first things I need to say to you is that hearing you call international consensus an oxymoron might just be the best first step in fixing what's become known as our global carbon problem.
Okay. And in a sense, Robin, it's the way you see the global carbon problem. And you see, we have immediately defined it as a carbon problem. We've said, look, CO2 is rising. We have a CO2 problem, but we've got to really step back and say, look, we have a symptom. The symptom is a rise in CO2. And sure, we can clean up the mess on the floor, the symptom, but we really have to get to the heart of it, which is what is causing the rise of CO2. And of course, when we get to the cause, we come back to agriculture. You know, the last 8,000 years, we've been oxidizing carbon from our landscapes through clearing forests, burning forests, cultivating soils, always oxidizing carbon out, which is where we have that CO2 increase. So the issue isn't the CO2 increase. In a sense, the CO2 is a resource and a symptom as a consequence of our excessive oxidation.
Yes.
That oxidation is really what we've got to address because we're so focused on that symptom.
Yes. Now, Walter, I've heard it told that you retired some years ago from research to go work directly with the soil. So I think you might just be the busiest retired person alive. I don't think you knew how busy you'd be.
Well, look, okay, and of course I'm not alone. There's literally billions of farmers connected and working with the soil all the time. But I was in research and did retire, and we did form a little group initially called Healthy Soils Australia, but now that's grown bigger into another NGO called Regenerate Earth. And so you're welcome to have a look at regenerate-earth as a site, because it's all about actually the soil. And it's regenerating the health of the soil carbon sponge, regenerating the bioproductivity, biofertility of those soils, which is really fundamental for our future.
Australia is one of the most exaggerated examples of the hydrological extremes that are going on. Can you share a bit about that and then move into the soil carbon sponge itself? And I know there are many examples in Australia where you're seeing that this type of concentration and work in this direction is definitely paying off.
Yeah, well, look, thank you. And of course, you're right. Australia is the driest inhabited continent. And basically, we're at the forefront, in the front line of this climate change. We're getting a systemic aridification of southern Australia, some 30% less rainfall. In northern Australia, we're getting more rainfall, but it's more extreme, more variable, more unreliable. So on all fronts, it's actually, yes, landscapes and hydrology. And in a sense, we're at that front line where we know that's an imperative for our future because, see, agriculture has always relied on reliable seasons. We have to have enough time to get a reliable crop, but that's out the window now. And really, it's how do we adapt and basically build resilience and buffering in our agricultural, in our whole human relationship to the climate, where we can overcome this unreliability, these extremes. It's actually, yeah, dangerous hydrological climate extremes that are accelerating, which are the things that are going to crunch civilizations in this coming decades. The hurricanes, floods, droughts, aridification, wildfires, and they're the things that actually destroy biosystems, destroy communities, kill people, and these are accelerating. And of course, we've got to address that. And that's partly, again, coming to the oxymoron, because we're all so focused on CO2 and aspirational token emission reductions. But quite frankly, the real danger, the reality is hydrology and these accelerating dangerous extremes.
So when you start talking about the soil sponge, that's square one, isn't it?
Right. Okay, this is then getting to the fundamentals, because quite frankly, as humans, we have agency on this planet, on geochemical processes on this planet, through only one mechanism, right? And that is our land management. Okay, so humans, yes, can influence the planet, climate, biosystems in one way, our management of our soils and landscapes. And really, it's regenerating the Earth's soil carbon sponge, which is the only point of agency we have to actually restore the hydrology, the biosystems which depend on that hydrology, and of course, the climate. And in a sense, there's all the scientific links substantiating that. But the real message is we only have one point of agency for good or bad. We can either oxidize, degrade, or we can regenerate by rebuilding the Earth's soil carbon sponge. As President Roosevelt once told us in the Dust Bowl, a nation that destroys its soils destroys itself. And that's so, so true. But we globally are facing that reality, that imperative, this coming decade, and it's either do or die as a consequence.
Right. And in that do or die, you certainly are talking good news, because this is not something that's going to take 1,000 years. If we work with the soil, that does not take a long time. It's incredible how quickly the earth can regenerate. So, Walter, what do you say? What's our first step here?
It's when we regenerate the sponge, we empower ourselves with this incredible force multiplier, which is hydrology, because it's not the carbon in the sponge
right,
that actually is doing the work. It's actually the fact that the sponge can hold water. Now, if we just step back into science a little bit, climatology 101, 95% of the Earth's heat dynamics and therefore climate is governed by water. The CO2 component of the greenhouse effect governs less than 4% of that heat dynamics. So you can see immediately we have a 20-fold multiplier capacity by working with hydrology. And if we now bring these natural hydrological cooling processes into play by regenerating the Earth's soil carbon sponge, yes, we can actually safely and naturally cool the planet, offset all the greenhouse effect, literally within weeks, years, everywhere, safely and naturally. But the big problem is we've got to change our mindsets. We've got to get out of this oxymoron, this dogma that we've got a CO2 problem. No, we haven't. We've got a warming problem, and therefore we need cooling rather than flogging ourselves with CO2. CO2 is the resource that we must use, but basically there's so much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, in the oceans, and it will take thousands of years, even if we stop all fossil fuel emissions, before there would be a re-equilibration and a stabilization of the climate through CO2. But simply because the oceans contain 50 times as much CO2 dissolved in them, and any emission reduction or any drawdown we do just on carbon, the oceans will re-equilibrate it back into the atmosphere. And so it'll take thousands of years, and of course we'll be long gone by then. But by using hydrology, by building the sponge, using that force multiplier of hydrology, yes, we can safely, naturally cool it, as I said, within weeks, within years.
Yes. Now, another interesting thing is the way we think about things, as you've just mentioned. Let's think about water a little differently. Everyone says, oh, water is a liquid, but au contraire, right? If you're a plant in the desert, you're not looking for a lot of water in the liquid form, are you?
Well, look, absolutely. Now, water, of course, is this miraculous, beautiful material. It covers 71% of the Earth's surface in oceans, average depth of 4,000 meters. But it's actually such a fundamental determinant of life, but also these planetary systems. But you're talking about phase changes, and this is exactly, well, let's get into cooling. See, if we take 1 gram of water, 1 cubic centimeter of water, and basically for that to evaporate or transpire, it needs heat energy. So every tree, every piece of green vegetation that's transpiring and taking water from the soil up into the atmosphere is actually requiring 590 calories or thereabouts of heat energy to turn from liquid to gas. And it has to take that energy from the Earth's surface and bring it up into the upper atmosphere. In that process, it's cooling the surface. So this is nature's air conditioning. That transpiration, evaporation effect at the moment on the planet, with less than half of the green Earth land cover that we had previously, is basically even now returning 24% of the incident solar radiation the Earth gets back up into the upper atmosphere and then mostly out to space. So here we are. We've got transpiration, green vegetation, cooling the planet, 24% of the incident solar radiation. So hypothetically, it's a bit more complicated, but a 4% increase in transpiration, a 4% increase in green vegetation would offset all the warming we've induced to date abnormally through human activity. And it comes so simple and so positive and direct, but it requires a mind change.
So with that in mind, with that mind change, can you share an example where you've seen some regenerative building up of the soil sponge and what positive effects it's shown?
Yes, Robin, no question at all. And of course, farmers all over the planet are doing this. And you've got them in the Americas, we've got them in Australia, Europe, everywhere. And this is farmers sort of regenerating the Earth's soil carbon sponge, taking carbon from the air through plants and then biosequestering that carbon into their soils. Basically, farmers are doing up to 10 tons of carbon per hectare per annum, biosequestrating it through that process. But it's not a matter of everyone has to do 10. It's whatever you're doing, even if you're doing 5. The point is you're adding to that increment of carbon from the air back into the soil. The important thing is to go beyond just carbon accounting, but actually say, look, we are here to build the sponge. We're here to regenerate these soils, because only that gives you the hydrology, and it's only the hydrology that can give you the cooling. See, there's basically a bit of a dead end here if we just say, look, we're doing carbon accounting, but we're not actually rebuilding the soil. Okay, so innovative farmers are doing that. All farmers can do that. It's a simple matter of maximizing the carbon that's fixed by plants, but then minimizing how much of that carbon biomass is oxidized back to CO2. So it's just practical, profitable practices, not over-cultivating, over-fertilizing, excessive biocides, bare fallows. It's just good management practices to avoid that. And instead of that carbon going up as CO2, to allow the fungi in the soil to biosequester, convert it into humus and glomalin, stable soil carbon that's there for up to 1,000 years.
Yes. And Walter, as you had mentioned earlier, a 4% increase in vegetation can offset all of the warming caused through human activity. And I'm wondering, what do you see us needing to take into consideration, considering how much Earth gets concretized every year, the buildings and all of that?
Okay, look, and this is then the question of, okay, how do we extend this rapidly, massively across the planet? And we've got something enormously powerful in our favor. You see, and this comes to the longevity of green growth. Everybody's always fixated, how can I grow things faster, bigger, which is in a sense what the Green Revolution was about. But in fact, the real power is in extending the longevity of green growth, how long things grow for. Does it grow for 20 days after a rainfall event, or is that water in the soils to allow that plant to grow for 200 days? You know, that's a tenfold increase in growth. And of course, we don't even dream about that. It's 1,000%. Science gets excited when it gets a 30% growth response. Well, here's 1,000% just by extending the longevity of green, because we've got the sponge working in our favor. So basically, that's the first powerful thing. But then also, we have created over 5 billion hectares of man-made desert and wasteland on this planet. That's 40% of its land area. And the potential is, can we regenerate some of that degraded rangeland, bring it back onto permanent green protective vegetation? And the answer is yes, we can. So both in terms of longevity and then the areas that we are regenerating, regreening, we have enormous leverage capacity. The wisest thing, of course, right in the beginning, is not to clear more forest and not to do more degradation.
Yes.
And of course, we're not saying we have to not reduce our fossil fuel emissions either. No one's saying that. But I'm saying it's just going way beyond just fossil fuel emission reductions, carbon accounting, to rebuild the sponge, to rebuild hydrology, longevity of green, and then regenerating some of these arid wastelands.
Yes, absolutely. And Walter, I'm not sure if you could answer this question briefly or not, but how will we see the ocean change as our newly regenerated soil carbon sponges grow in numbers?
Yep. Okay, look, the oceans is an enormously powerful influence and buffer on the Earth's climate. 71% of the planet is covered in oceans, 4,000 meters deep on average, and it's an enormous heat sink and it's enormous carbon sink. So first of all efforts we have at just reducing emissions through carbon are basically re-equilibrated by the world's oceans, so that as we draw down carbon, the oceans will say thank you very much and just release some of that 38,000 billion tons of carbon that is dissolved in it back into the atmosphere. And so it will re-equilibrate, which means it'll take thousands of years for our efforts to reduce emissions to have an effect on the climate. Far, far too late to stop catastrophic climate change. Okay, so the oceans are very, very powerful as that buffer. Up to now, we haven't been seeing the serious effects because the oceans have buffered the negatives, but that means they're also going to be slower. Also, at the moment, the oceans are absorbing 93% of the extra heat that's being retained by the Earth. Okay, it's going in, warming the oceans. And again, we haven't seen anything yet of global warming because the oceans are acting as a buffer. And again, it makes this only thing we've got is the actual safe natural cooling through these hydrological processes. It's the only way we can actually sidestep that lag effect from the ocean.
Got it.
So, yeah, the oceans are enormously powerful as a buffer, having regulated our climate, but they're so massively big that, yeah, we have got to go beyond those buffer effects to direct natural safe cooling, because we need that cooling within years at the local level.
Yes, and as you mentioned earlier, we can do that.
Yeah, look, I mean, no, I wouldn't sort of be clapping ourselves quite yet, because here's the science. There's no question about the science. Here's, again, how nature uses it. But no, we humanity are still in that black hole captured by the whole CO2 greenhouse and that whole dogma of emission reductions. And quite frankly, yeah, this is a ladder out of the black hole. We can get out of it. But at the moment, it's not mainstream. It's still quite innovative. And people are saying, well, possibly it couldn't be that natural. It couldn't be that simple. But look, we have stunning examples. I live in a city called Canberra, the capital city of Australia. 100 years ago, it was just a fairly bare, degraded, dry landscape. Marion Mahoney, Walter Burley Griffin, when they designed the city and established it, the first thing they did is they created an urban forest to actually provide cooling, mesic habitat. Those areas that were then established 100 years are now 12 degrees centigrade cooler on a summer's day compared to the adjacent concrete suburbs. Okay, so here's a case study, 100 years old, a city of 400,000 people, and an enormous effect in terms of the heat stress, the health consequences, the sort of environment we can live in. And we can do that everywhere within a decade at a local community level.
Absolutely.
And that's the sort of empowerment we're talking about.
Perfect, perfect. Walter, you bring such good news, and I'm wondering if you have any other sage advice, whether philosophical or otherwise, that might help to recalibrate our innate capabilities here.
Well, look, yeah, I'm not normally in that game, but but look, I think you just come back to reason and simple reality and physics. The Earth basically had rock and oceans 4.2 billion years ago, and basically it used these processes we're talking about, the microbial drawdown of carbon to build soils, to build life, as its ways where it then created the cooler, buffered systems which we evolved in. So nature uses exactly these same microbial soil pedogenesis processes to have created the terrestrial ecosystems we depend on, we evolved in, and to regulate them. And so the simple thing is that, yes, we have to respect and reutilize the same natural processes. And why? Because it's the only point of agency humans have affecting these planetary systems. It's actually the management of our soils. So we're standing on the solution. The whole archaeology of civilizations, most of them have collapsed because they've destroyed their soils, and they're seen in the dust of archaeology. Civilizations have avoided that, but only through the wise management of their soils, the rebuilding of the soil carbon sponge, the rebuilding of their hydrology, and through that, their safe future.
Bravo. Well, I can't wait to share the story of your hometown with the world, Walter. This will be great.
Well, and it's, of course, a case study that goes around the world, because here are wise human grassroots innovation, planting trees, building porous landscapes and safely naturally cooling their habitat rapidly. And we can do this everywhere within a decade. We must do that.
Yes.
That's the point of agency, but that's also the point of equity, right? So yes, very much it's the crisis that we're going to face. There are seven missed meals between social stability and chaos. And so we really have to rebuild the resilience, the equity in our biosystems, because that's where we evolved in. That's what keeps things peaceful. And really, that's where our future is.
Mark, you're involved in a few aspects of Regen Ag. Where did you first jump in?
So I was reading a bunch of books, including biomimicry and natural capitalism, and originally working in the renewable energy field. And then in 2013, I connected with a group that was making a loan to one of the largest and oldest organic farms in Colorado. And that ended up being somewhat of a painful lesson, but got me on the path of soil and actually led to us purchasing Lewis Family Farm later that year in 2013. We're heading into our ninth growing season now. It's been a very fun adventure.
Yes, and you were fortunate to purchase an organically certified farm here in Colorado. But to truly farm sustainably and regeneratively, there's a bit more involved. And I'm wondering, what were some of your first steps in taking your farm in this direction?
Yes. So the first year, we spread 80 semi-loads of compost with the aim of supercharging the soil biology.
For how many acres was that, the 80 loads?
350 acres.
Okay.
So the goal was to put like roughly a quarter of an inch of compost across all of the irrigated acres. You know, we did soil tests, the Haney test, and our soil organic matter average was around 1.3% when we purchased the farm. And, you know, we're now up above 2%. We've also incorporated livestock integration, cover cropping, green manure, more perennial crops, all kind of with the aim of increasing soil organic matter, which doesn't exactly capture it. But one of my primary objectives has been to try to prove that if you're building soil organic matter, therefore sequestering atmospheric carbon into your soil, is there also yield improvement and nutrient density improvement of the crops you're growing? And some of that has played out in the relative feed quality of the alfalfa that we grow.
What cover crops did you plant?
So we've done a Sudan grass that we then just plowed in as kind of a green manure. We have done a hairy vetch. We've done a clover. I ended up doing a hemp crop last year that I was growing for seed to process into hemp hearts that ended up unintentionally being a cover crop. But hemp is a bioaccumulator and phytoremediator. And the Rodale Institute has shown some, you know, benefits of hemp as a cover crop. But that one was admittedly somewhat unintentional on my part.
I don't think you're the only one that happened to.
Yeah, and that market has been a little bit of a wild ride for sure.
I bet, yes. Now, in hindsight, Mark, is there a glaring setback or surprise that stands out to you? And maybe what you just mentioned with the hemp might be the thing.
Yeah, that was a surprise. You know, we've had a couple of pretty devastating hailstorms that took out one year's corn crop almost entirely. The first year we planted wheat in 2014, there was a really, really wet spring. And so all of the wheat in the area got rust, which is a form of a fungus. And so just the vagaries of weather, for sure, have been a challenge. And, you know, other than that, things break down. We have wells and irrigation pivots, and there are challenges every season, for sure, that you can't foresee. But that's also the joy of when you actually do have a successful harvest. And even more importantly, over nine seasons, seeing the soil health increase is rewarding and worth all the surprises and pain points.
Sure. Now, my experience in listening to all of the guests on Cultivated Audio is that commodities are transforming back into communities. And as you write in the Perennial Fund's manifesto, there's a huge benefit when competition turns to cooperation, and that's
a huge direction that's happening these days. And I'm excited to hear about your other adventures, which are redefining business practices in farming. So I know one of the key aspects of successful farming is knowing the financial side, and some of that capital, maybe most, is actually plain old hard work, but some is also the good old dollar, and you're taking a generous path as a managing partner at Trailhead Capital and with your involvement with the folks at the Perennial Fund. So what's the mission here, Mark, and explain a little bit of how it works and who can benefit? Besides the whole planet.
Yes. So the Perennial Fund is spun out of the Mad Agriculture, which is a nonprofit where I volunteer on the board, founded by Dr. Phil Taylor. And the Perennial Fund, the mission there is to make loans to farmers who are transitioning additional acreage to organic and regenerative organic practices. It's a unique loan mechanism where it's a revenue share. So once the farmer has achieved their organic certification, then we are paid back via a revenue share mechanism. So our risk is aligned with the risk of the farmer during the three-year transition period where you're cleaning up the soil and proving that there are no contaminants, pesticides, herbicides, etc. That's an economic hit to the farmer because they're not yet getting the certified organic price premium. And typically there's a drop in yield because you're no longer using synthetic nitrogen or other synthetic inputs. So Perennial Fund, we raised $10 million and are now going to be deploying loans this growing season to farmers across the Midwest. And then Trailhead Capital, we are just launching a new venture capital fund. So I'm an accidental venture capitalist, but I've convinced myself that there's a huge opportunity to place capital with entrepreneurs and companies in the early stages that are developing innovative, new, paradigm-shifting food and agriculture businesses with kind of a regenerative lens. So we invest through the lens of, you know, soil is paramount, and then a systems thinking approach and really trying to think through how does this affect all stakeholders. And as you are well aware, I've convinced myself that soil is really the link between planetary health and human health. And we're in a crisis of sorts on both of those fronts. And so I think soil is a worthy place to place our attention. That's what the Perennial Fund and Trailhead Capital are trying to channel more funding and more energy into various soil-based solutions.
Now, obviously, you're helping out financially. Are you also a resource for these farmers to find out the hows and the whys and best case scenarios for what they're trying to accomplish in those 3 years?
For sure. So on the Perennial Fund, in addition to capital, there's some technical assistance that comes through our team and our network. And then there's a big focus on community and saying, let's create a new sense of community or a reinvigorated sense of community and knowledge sharing, creating new, you know, decommoditized markets for these organic and regenerative organic crops. That's a big component to not just be another bank, but also the technical assistance and the sense of community and really ushering in a new era of more holistic practices and hopefully a more dignified and economically viable path forward for farmers.
So, Mark, when Trailhead is looking for folks, who is coming to talk to you? Are they mostly folks that are new to farming or they're already involved in farming? What are you looking for in your investments with people?
So our focus is on seed and Series A stage companies and entrepreneurs that typically have some revenue and some product market fit and some traction in the marketplace. And we have three investment verticals. One is on-farm producer focused. So that's things like we're looking at some interesting robotics, autonomous tractors, biological inputs, etc. Second category is post-producer or sort of in the supply chain. So that's some interesting software companies that are improving transparency and traceability around food ingredients and really trying to better communicate to the consumer where their food is coming from and prove that it, you know, doesn't have heavy metals or pesticides or, you know, glyphosate in it. And then the third piece is on the consumer side, where we're investing in beyond organic consumer packaged goods companies. So, you know, the new regenerative organic certification that was spearheaded by Rodale Institute, Patagonia, and Dr. Bronner's is now, you know, rolling out. And so we're looking at companies that are achieving either the bronze, silver, or gold ROC certification. And then another great example of kind of beyond organic is the Savory Institute Land to Market Ecological Outcome Verification Certification, where they're actually going out and ground truthing and verifying that soil health benefits have been achieved as a result of the beef jerky, or, you know, there's a Timberland leather boot that now has Land to Market certification, where, you know, that animal was part of a holistic management system where soil health was paramount.
That's so fantastic. And hearing you speak about equipment and software, that's a lot of foresight. Farmers are so ensconced in what they're doing, and that's all there's time for, to get up and manage your farm and go to sleep and get some rest for the next day. And now, due to technology, and my gosh, just having a phone, there's so much that can be learned and benefited from all of that side of things. So thank you so much for doing this. That's really fantastic to hear about.
Yes, absolutely. And technology has not been particularly broadly applied to food and agriculture. An example, one of our first three portfolio companies at Trailhead Capital is a company called Vents, which is a virtual fencing solution. So this is a collar that you actually put on the cow. Through GPS, you can control where the cows go. So it's a virtual fence. What we're really excited about is that we think this hardware-software combination can really be a low-cost way for more ranchers to implement holistic management, kind of multi-paddock intensive grazing methodologies, which have been proven to, you know, sequester atmospheric carbon. And that's really mimicking the predator-prey relationship of, say, the bison and the wolves, where the animals are moving relatively in tight packs, relatively quickly across the landscape. And that is largely, you know, how the topsoil built up in the first place across the Great Plains.
Of course.
And that's one of our principles, follow the intelligence of nature. But we're not afraid to use technology to do so. You know, the other thing, I could point to one other portfolio company. It's another technology solution that we're excited about. It's a company called HowGood. If you have the Chipotle app on your phone, you can actually drill down and understand the greenhouse gas profile of the carnitas versus the barbacoa versus the tofu, or the water profile of the pinto bean versus the black bean. And that technology is one of our portfolio companies called HowGood.
Right. Very nice. Now, Mark, you mentioned that on your farm you have introduced animals. And so what's your favorite steak?
Ooh. I would probably say the New York Strip.
All right. And then, Mark, what's your favorite part of actually having a farm?
Just having a opportunity to get out of the city and the concrete jungle and observe that we have owls and hawks and pheasants and deer, and just to observe the wildlife and take my two daughters out there and show them where food comes from and what soil is and why daddy gets excited when there's an earthworm in a shovel full of soil. And all of those things are probably my favorite aspect.
Yeah, that's great. Guero Lesson, Walter Yenne, and Mark Lewis. Thank you. All outstanding in their fields. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. Thanks for being here and for making here where we want to be.